Hello, and welcome to Shed Talks. I'm Jeremy Thomas. I give talks on good mental health. I write books. I spent an eon of time in the music business, and now I'm here. Shed Talks is going to be a series of conversations with interesting people. And they're going to talk about many things. They're going to talk about their mental health, other people's mental health. And they're going to talk about life jackets, what keeps them afloat. And I hope you're going to enjoy it. I think it's going to be great. Don't rush off at the end of the chat, because we've got our own very, very special psychologist, Karen Cowan, who's going to spend the last few minutes talking about the program and talking about what's gone on, a little bit of insight for us and what you can do to get over some of the problems ahead. So don't run away. So, welcome to episode 2 of Shed Talks. And we are completely delighted to have as our guest Charlie Mortimer. Charlie Mortimer is one of those people who you scratch your head and go, yeah, I know him, but how do I know him? Well, how you know him really is as the author and editor of several books, notably Dear Lupin and Lucky Lupin. And these were based on letters written by Charlie's father to him over a 35-year period. And they are quite extraordinary letters. And Charlie is quite an extraordinary person. He has had many different careers. And to say he is a survivor is a tiny understatement. Charlie has worked on oil rigs, has been a boxer short manufacturer, has worked in Kenya, in Poland, has done all sorts of extraordinary things, including being a member of the Coldstream Guards. Charlie, really a big welcome to Shed Talks.
Thank you for that very, very generous introduction. Which halfway through, I thought you were talking about something completely different. So perhaps I'll ask you to do it again, but at another time. Anyway, Jeremy, it's a joy to be here.
Well, thank you and welcome to the Shed. I wondered if I could go on. I know that I don't want to spend the program talking about, what happened with Dear Lupin and Lucky Lupin. But I really just wanted to say it would be really nice if you wouldn't mind if I read from the preface of that book and the dedication that you made to your father, because I think it's really something.
Oh, brilliant.
This book is a tribute to my dad and a big thank you to him for never giving up on me. Despite my endless shortcomings, failures, disasters, and general inability to live up to the high hopes and aspirations he and my mother had for me, which, as these letters show over time, became slightly more realistic. Initially, there were hopes that I would get my house colours at Eton and become an officer in the Coldstream Guards. Ultimately, my dad merely hoped that I would avoid being taken away in a Black Mirage police car, together with my then business associates and now infamous John Hobbs, colourful Chelsea antiques dealer to the mega wealthy, and his brother Carlton. However, it is now 20 years on since my dad died, and I suspect he would be delighted that now almost 60, the same age he was when he wrote to me those early letters, I had at least survived thus far and was moderately happy. My dad was enormously self-deprecating. He saw himself as a patiently enduring and thoroughly respectable middle-class gentleman, much along the lines of Mr. Pooter in The Diary of a Nobody, whilst I was the disreputable son, Lupin, who was always getting into frightful scrapes. Thus, many of the letters start, "My dear Lupin," before launching into a thoroughly bleak assessment of my current situation and future prospects. The early letters were largely of concern and admonishment, but as time went by, a resigned acceptance of the way things were crept in. Despite everything, my father never showed me anything other than affection and tolerance. Charlie, it must have been quite therapeutic for you, I guess, in putting together this book, Dear Lupin, and indeed writing your own really candid autobiography, Lucky Lupin.
Yeah, I think the Lucky Lupin was the one for me, because that was the book I wanted to write. The Dear Lupin was very much a tribute to my dad. And I remember clearly my lovely editor, Andreas, saying, "You're quite funny, but you're nowhere near as funny as your father, so should we just keep your contribution to a bare minimum?" And I took his advice, and I felt that we didn't need to compete for space. So really, in Dear Lupin, I'm framing his letters with the odd remark. You know, one or two people mentioned that it was shockingly edited, but that was actually the intention.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it's an extraordinary thing to have in the 21st century, letters from your father, which would seem to me almost to be written on a fortnightly basis.
Well, no, it was. And I mean, my dad was a hugely prolific letter writer, you know, because he wrote as many, if not more, letters to my sisters, to friends. And I reckon after his stint as a prisoner of war, and the fact that, you know, my parents' marriage was somewhat turbulent at times, this was a kind of therapy for him.
Yeah, got it. Well, as you know, I mean, this sort of show is you know, got a lot to do with mental health, but hopefully in an interesting way and perhaps not on the nose. But I know that three or four things happened to you by the age of 15 that some people could say were mildly traumatic for a child. What would you say about that?
Yeah, the one thing I would never, ever be described as is a victim. So I just tend to crack on, you know. I think I said to you earlier that at Eton, myself and my good friend Jerry Soames, having gone up to visit a lady of the night, namely Denise Bunny, and we were caught out by fire practice. Anyway, thanks to the intervention of his godfather, Monty, the field marshal, we, instead of being sacked, we were flogged, which involved being held down, bare-assed, and beaten till you bled. Well, it never bothered me tuppence and it hasn't since, frankly, nor has it Jerry. So, you know, I come from a different generation.
Yes, but having said that, would you prescribe that as a really good method of, you know, dealing with people?
No, and also I can assure you I haven't spent my entire life trawling through small ads to relive the experience either.
So it's sort of stuff and nonsense then.
Yeah, it's up to the individual, but I often think, you know, if things are put into people's heads, then they tend to think that's it. And, you know, if somebody had said, "This is disgraceful, it's ruined your life, you've got to sue the school," you know, I may have thought differently, but I didn't. So, you know, hey, there we go.
Yeah, I understand that. But there's a sort of duality here that, you know, some people say, "Oh, well, if you're given a diagnosis of that, you know that you're a serious depressive or you're anorexic or something, then you're just going to behave like you are, you know, whilst if you didn't give them that, then you might pull through." But actually, for you know, I'm not saying this universally, but for some people, having a diagnosis can be the most amazing, liberating thing going, because they go, well, that's what the trouble was. And now I know what I can do.
I agree. But I think it's horses for courses. I mean, in my early 30s, I was a mess almost beyond belief. I remember on my 30th birthday, I was so appalled at the circumstances in which I find myself staying with friends. I couldn't admit that I was 30. And not long after that, I ended up in Broadway Lodge for serious drug addiction, including heroin, speed and alcohol and a drug called Ativan and God knows what else. And I absolutely loved it there. I became head boy. My father wrote to me and said that, you know, now, the first time you've been head boy of anything. And I really felt I could contribute there and enter into the spirit of things. And I went away and I picked up two words, and that was take responsibility. And not long after that, I got diagnosed in 1985. With what was called HTLV-3, which is now HIV, and I had AIDS-related condition. Had I not been to Broadway Lodge, I think things could have fallen apart pretty drastically. So, you know, these lessons come and go.
Yes. But that's quite a jump, isn't it, from being beaten at Eton.
Yes.
Being 30 and a heroin addict and various other things. I mean, I have a friend of mine from the music business who's quite a well-known chap, and he became heroin addict. And I said, what was it that drove you to it? And he said, oh, nothing drove me to it. It was just the band didn't work for 18 months and I had nothing to do. So I was bored. Oh. And I decided to take heroin. But, you know, I think we would be very naive if we just said, oh, yes, well, everyone who gets bored takes heroin, and that's the only reason you do things. People, you know, often use these things to medicate what's going on in their head, what's going on inside. And I'm not trying to make it easy peasy, but I'm interested that you don't seem to think that.
I do think that, but theoretically, I mean, after I've been to Broadway Lodge, I gave up alcohol for like 10 years. And so on. But I now do drink. I now do take all sorts of things. I probably do self-medicate. But I'm aware of the warning signs when things will get seriously out of hand. But having said that, you know, everybody is completely different. You can't expect the same rule for all. And I remember once, after I'd had HIV for like 10 years, I was interviewed by GQ magazine. And some people came up to me very cross. They said, how could anybody possibly identify with that? And I said, well, I didn't actually write, you know, I wasn't intending for people to identify with it. I was just telling as it was for me.
Your story, yeah.
And I've often found this in my days when I went to Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. People used to say, you know, you've got to look after the newcomer. Well, to me, a newcomer would only really be interested in the truth, not to have messages apparently tailored to attract them, if that makes any sense.
Well, yes, I get what you're saying, Charlie, up to a point. Because surely your message would be really good for a newcomer. I mean, you came back from, well, you know, a sort of semi-abyss.
Yeah.
Via AA and NA and Broadway Lodge. And you then went on and spent 10 years clean and sober, as it were, and then you got it all back together. So I would have thought that was pretty interesting for a newcomer. And I submit to you, as somebody wedded to the truth, or to being honest, that you should see that, if I can say that. I mean, I know I've got a few banners in my hand, you know, about this subject. But I think, you know, newcomers to me are people who really want to hear the truth. They want verite, they want authenticity. And I would think it would be great for them to listen to you without any shadow of a doubt. The truth will set you free. Anyway, without jumping into the next subject,
yes,
can I just lead you down a small path?
Yeah, of course.
Because I always think you're a very interesting person. You've got a great take on certain things, specifically on depression. And I know that depression came to visit you for whatever unknown reason when you were at school, and then seems to have been a frequent guest virtually ever since. And I really liked your description of depression.
It's so hard to describe it, but it was literally like lying with your eyes closed on a beach in Greece somewhere, and you know the sun's coming down and you feel all lovely and warm, and then unknown to you because your eyes are closed, a huge cloud obscures the sun and suddenly you feel icy cold. And that is really when depression takes over. It feels like that.
Yeah.
Like ending up in an utterly joyless vacuum. And it doesn't really matter how many times you've had depression. I never find it any easier to deal with. And obviously, because of the very nature of depression, you're going to think you're going to be depressed forever, of course.
Well, there you go. I'm glad you said what you said. I think, you know, if you're going to give any gift to newcomers, people who suffer from depression, that would be it. I think the danger with depression is that, you know, when you have it, you think you haven't got it, you know, and that's one of the ironies of being depressed. You know, it's just one of those things, I think. And you tend to believe that this is how it really is, you know. Just this will always be like this, and I will always be like this, and there is no ending. When in fact, we all know that's not true and that depressions do lift. So I suppose, you know, taking the Charlie Mortimer message, you know, one needs to say, if you've got a mate who knows that you've gone through this depression before, you know, you go, look, last March, you were depressed, but by the end of April, you were not. These things can lift. And I think it's so important that, and to be delivered by somebody who knows what they're talking about. Otherwise, we just revert to despair international.
Well, it is. I mean, both my mother suffered from very bad depression. My younger sister does. They were both on medication. Because I got epilepsy, for some reason I can't take antidepressants, so I deal with it in other ways. And I've always found cognitive therapy extremely helpful.
Right, CBT, yeah. Yeah, it does work. It does work for a lot of people.
Yeah.
One really boring question.
Yes.
That I read somewhere, or I heard an interview with you, and I thought you said you'd had ADHD. Attention deficit disorder, but I don't know whether you did or whether you didn't.
No, I did. I had it when I was at school, when I was about 14 or 15, and I remember being prescribed then Dexedrine. If I'd had any idea what fun they were, I would have taken them. But
I think that's speed in other people's language. Isn't it?
It is dexamphetamine sulfate. But it's funny, just on that, you were saying earlier about, I mean, I almost have a sort of Asperger's syndrome about honesty. And when I wrote Lucky Lupin, a good friend of mine who's a publisher, James Pembroke, read it and was very kind. And he said, look, I'm never, ever going to put you in a room with my father who does have Asperger's syndrome. And he said, you and he together would be just a never-ending escalator of frankness and honesty. He said, I just couldn't cope with. And a lot of people can't cope with it. I've just done a pitch for being a director at an AGM. I'm currently chair of this sort of voluntary thing. And I don't think anybody can cope with it, because I said at the beginning, you know, I'm writing this to feel better. And then launched into everything that I thought was wrong with it and the people in it. Tim reckons I can piss more people off more quickly than he can dang glasses of cheap fizz, which is saying something.
Surely not. Yeah. Surely not. Okay, I want to try something on you, what you think about this. I used to work in the music business. When I was when I started, I was 20, sort of, you know, proper. And I got introduced to a guy called Dennis Preston, who owned very snazzy studios called Lansdowne. And I'd been sort of, you must meet this man. And I went to meet him at 10 in the morning and went to, very charming. And he pulled out a huge glass of brandy.
Right.
And said to me, would you like some? And I said, well, actually, no, I don't normally drink that time of morning. And he said, oh, well, don't mind me. He said, don't worry, I never, ever get drunk. And the thing is that I was told 2 years ago that if I didn't stop drinking, I would die, you know, in 2 years. And so I just decided to carry on drinking. And I told my wife and I told my kids, and there you go. And I'm very happy. There we go. And he did die 2 years later. And he was a very, very charming, very nice man. And I suppose I want to know a comment on that. And this is maybe very loaded, but Ian Hislop recently wrote in the Times about one of his regrets.
Right.
And he said, Peter Cook was my hero of all time. And we used to just laugh at him being drunk all the time. And he said, I regret not trying to help him. Loaded question, but where do you stand on all that?
Well, with my mother, you know, I took her to literally every treatment centre known to mankind, one of which she gave a promise. She gave a life story that lasted an hour and a half. And at the end of it, one of the groups said, that was very interesting, Cynthia. I said, the trouble is you never once mentioned alcohol, not once.
Right. Anyway, what do you think now about your mum? Was that predestined accident or?
Well, you know, she lived to a good age. And even in the last days, it was brandy for breakfast. I mean, I remember way back, the old time, to put my family in context, we were off to the races. And I was caught taking a half tumbler full of whiskey at about 11 in the morning by my mother. And rather than berate me, she said, oh, if you would have a drink, I'm bloody well going to have one too. And then my older sister came in and saw both of us, and she said, well, I'm bloody well having one as well. So, you know, that was the way it tended to work.
Yes.
I mean, in the final years of my mother's life, Tim, my partner, you know, and I went down every single weekend, and it always the same thing happened. Is Tim and my mother used to sit down, drink 2 litres of cheap Frascati, and I used to go around checking that everything was working in the fences. Then I'd come in, and they were both absolutely blotto, with my mother with a wig on the tilt and a chihuahua under one arm, saying, "Oh, Tim and I are absolutely d'accord," and you know, so. Throughout my entire life with my family, alcohol played a huge role.
Yes, yes.
But there you go. The awful day when my mother, terrible depression back in 1988, and we came back from the pub, and anyway, cut a long story short, she tried to kill herself, and I found her, I thought she had a stroke. I rang up the local doctor, who unbelievably on a bank holiday Monday was round within 5 minutes, and he said, you know, you better kiss your mother goodbye, she definitely won't make it. Anyway, she did make it. She woke up 2 days later in hospital, and her, do you know, her first words... Oh, to a nurse, she said, oh, have I missed Ascot?
Something out of sort of Bride's Head Revisited, Enders, something. I mean, it's extraordinary, extraordinary. But okay, not, this isn't to trip you up, I just want to know that you decided not to tell your father that you'd contracted AIDS. Is that right?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think I'd put him through enough by then. And you've got to remember, Jeremy, you know, this was like having Ebola with social consequences. You know, if my local laundrette in Parsons Green had got to hear about it, they'd have been burning my sheets. They wouldn't have been washing them.
Yes.
And it was way, way back in time. And my father didn't even know I was gay, for God's sake.
Right.
I mean, I didn't for some time because I used to ride under both sets of rules, as they say, and once got engaged and so on and so on. And when I actually did discover that I was seriously ill with it, you know, I thought, well, I better try and tell people, I guess I better mention I'm gay. So I rang up my friend Caroline Broom White and said, Caroline, you know that girl I've been banging on about for months? Oh, she said, yes. I said, well, actually, she's a bloke. Oh, my God, she said, how awful. How did you find out?
That's a very funny story, I have to say.
And there was the other one where a year or so later, I was with my mother, with her first cousin, Robin Denison Pender, who was honestly like Gussie Finknottle out of a P.G. Woodhouse book. And we were in the Turf Club in London. And at the end of lunch, my mother said to Robin, you do know, of course, that Charlie's got HIV, don't you? To which pinstripe-suited Robin slapped his thigh twice and said, well done, you. He'd obviously thought it was like an OBE or something.
Oh, my God.
So it had its moments. And, you know, a lot of people think I'm flip, but that's the way I deal with life. It's the way my father dealt with life. And I like to think if I inherited anything from my father, it was the ability to have gallows humour in the face of adversity.
And to deal with things.
Yeah.
You quite like the idea of having a remote control, is that correct?
Well, it was only when I shared a house in the 70s with some friends. You know, we had a rented telly that everybody used to have rented tellies in, and you had contrast, and you could really make a big mess of the picture. And then there was a button, it just on N for normal. And if you pressed that button, everything returned to default position of utterly normal. You know, it was like going to Peter Jones.
So, right, well, we've worked out how you're going to make £1 billion. Okay, we're now heading towards the life jackets area, but I'm going to switch the around a little bit and say to you that Dr. McTavish, a Scottish doctor, in 1876, August the 9th, said, in answer to a question of what do you need to be happy? And he said, "Ach, indeed, you need three things. Someone to love, something to do, and something to hope for." And what I wondered, I have a pretty good idea how you're going to answer this. But, you know, what's your view of that? And what really, perhaps, I don't know, I don't want to say saved because that's wrong, but who's the head of life jackets in your life?
Oh, well, obviously, Tim. I mean, we've been together, we're into our 25th year shortly.
Amazing.
And he's 20 years younger than me, but that seems to be completely irrelevant. But my old boss, the highly charismatic and slightly disgraced antique dealer, John Hobbs, who's sadly deceased, used to say to anybody, do you know what? If you had met Charlie Mortimer before he met Tim, he was, and then went into a whole saga of what a nightmare, depression object I was. And it's, to me, it's been a complete life change. And we are a survival pact. You know, we both have a lot of quite odd things going on, but we don't highlight them. We put up with them. You know, he puts up with mine, I put up with his. You know, one of his is, I think he got frightened by a vacuum cleaner at a very early age because in 25 years, I don't think he's touched it more than twice.
But I think you're a very good match. And, you know, the great thing is I think you have a big laugh. And 25 years is 25 years in anyone's book. Something to do. How would you describe yourself in that area?
Well, somebody asked Tim the other day, how's Charlie been coping in lockdown? And Tim, without pause for thought, he said, fighting people. I spent my entire life getting involved in what I consider to be other people's injustices. And away we go.
Right. But you are a doer, aren't you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I have to be doing something.
What's your go-to, you know, when you're fed up? I mean, I've got a friend who, when he gets really fed up, really pissed off, he gets all of his shoes out and puts them on the kitchen table on a piece of newspaper and polishes and brushes them, cleans them, takes all Sunday evening.
Yeah, there's not a lot of that going on in our house. But I go for a walk. That's what I like to do. And even if it's the tiniest mission to go walk 5 miles by a roll of cotton, that'll do, and off I go. And I try to have a long walk in the morning, and then Tim and I always walk for an hour every late afternoon down to the River Thames towards Craven Cottage, and there isn't a single magnolia tree on that walk that we don't know pretty intimately. And we, you know, we have a laugh. Tim, bless him, for over 26 years worked on the front line at the job centre.
Right.
So he does have a pretty good understanding about, you know...
Life.
Life, exactly.
And what we could say would be a very grounded person.
Yeah. And he seems to live half his life in India at the moment, where due to Zoom and all these things, he's friends with this boy who met like 10 years ago in India, who's now married with kids. And Tim seems to know more about what goes on in an Indian village than any other man living. He's an expert on that from ACTAR in India. And his other thing of expertise is... my mother telling about fox hunting in Dorset in the 1930s.
Well, whatever floats your boat, I suppose. You know, India, Dorset, it's all very, very cosmopolitan. But being a bit more serious, you like being busy, I think, Charlie. You like physical activity, you know, whether it's sort of washing up, emptying the dishwasher, you know, working on cars, you are that kind of a person. And I never really asked you about gardening, whether or not you like gardening. And that's despite the fact you agreed kindly to read a couple of pages out of my grandfather's book, Making Love to Mother Earth. So a question, you know, do you actually like gardening?
No, because basically I don't have a garden. But I do like buying orchids in supermarkets. And there are quite a few on the kitchen table. I mean, often about 10. So I guess given the chance I would, but I've never had the chance, so I don't.
Right, okay. So let's move on now completely to the sort of life jackets area of this conversation. Things that keep you afloat, and in this particular instance, movies, films that you really, really like. And I know one of them is the original Mad Max. Am I right? Is that it?
Yes.
Is that because of your, you know, real love of cars and in particular high performance cars? Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I used to have this car called a Nissan Skyline, which was nicknamed in Japan the Coffin. And this was, I bought it back in 1992, 1993. And It was so streets ahead of Porsches and Ferraris and anything else. You know, it had the fastest time around the Nuremberg of any production car, and yet it looked pretty modest. It had one exhaust pipe, and it looked like just a modest coupe. But as I was ill at the time, it was like putting on a suit of armor and going into battle. Mm. It was fantastic.
Do you still have that?
Or? No, I kept it for 11 years. I mean, we haven't owned a car now for over 10 years. I just don't see the point.
So, okay, moving on. One of the other films that I know is a secret favourite of yours is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah.
That film is completely barking mad, isn't it? Actually, I really enjoyed it. It was despite being a bit ill at the time. But I love the idea of the time travel and the, you know, Doctor Who type thing, not exactly the same. And the Napoleon figure, I thought that was really, really good. I mean, do you like that because it's just bonkers and something that, you know, distracts you or what?
No, I just thought it was good fun. I mean, I like Keanu Reeves and I like the other boy in it, and it was just stupid and it was just funny, you know. I mean, that said, I remember having Christmas lunch with some people, one of whom was an Oscar judge, and he asked me what my favourite film was that year, and I said it was the Beverly Hillbillies, and he was absolutely furious. I got a whole barrage of what a moron philistine I obviously was, but, you know.
Well, you know, one man's philistine is another man's Barbara Windsor.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you go from Mad Max to Ted and Things Wonderful Adventure, and then to the Carry On series. You just love all of those films. I like certain Carry On films. Carry On Camping was a great one, and that's actually connected to somebody contributing to this series. What with old Barbara Windsor and the flying brassiere scene. What's your favourite Carry On film?
Carry On Up the Khyber.
Would it be any other, I ask myself. Very, very good choice. Now, if we turn to TV, it would appear, I hope I'm right in saying this, that the Antique Roadshow could be a bit of a favourite, yeah?
Well, it is now. I mean, I'm sad to say, because I've got various brain problems, quite a lot to do with the HIV drugs and this, that and the other. I haven't been able to read a book for years. I can write a book, but I can't read it because writing is an activity. I never read them back. I just send it off to poor old Andreas has to read it at the publishers. But I find it very, very, very hard to watch television. So I've now opted for the Antiques Roadshow, and usually I've had quite a few drinks by the time I lie down at about 10 o'clock. Turn it on because it's pre-recorded. I can usually get for about two valuations at a time. And it'll last me quite a long time because the next day I can't remember which valuations they were. So we go back to the beginning again.
I love that. I love that idea. You know, Groundhog Day in the Antique Roadshow is brilliant. I know that my wife is a very big fan of this program. So I do watch it now and again. And I don't know whether you ever would agree with me, perhaps you're too discreet, but I always think some of it is rather cruel. You know, when they've got a sort of couple, elderly couple, who've been queuing all day to get on the valuation platform, and they finally get there exhausted, and then they offer up their, you know, mahogany, ivory, and gold inlaid box, and sort of say to the expert, well, what do you think? And the expert says, well, it's absolutely fabulous. It's a beautiful piece. Has it been in the family long? And they go, oh, since, you know, the 1820s. And they go, oh, I thought it was. Well, perhaps you'd like to know how much it's worth. And they're going, oh, gosh, yes, please. And he goes, well, I think with a fair wind and a little bit of a polish up, you know. And they go, yes. And he goes, well, I think it could be worth £15. And they then go, oh, do you really? Oh, my God. That's so kind of you. Well, we won't be selling it because it's been in the family for 900 years. Bye. I just think to myself that, you know, it's a bit cruel, I think, and absolute nonsense. But there we go. That's just me and me being difficult. What would you say?
No, well, I mean, you'd rather wish somebody would say, is that all?
Definitely. Well, I think that's absolutely right. So what we are asking for, what we are demanding from the Shed Talks platform is more honesty and more value to customers in the Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a very good friend of mine who's the book expert there, Justin Croft. I call him Dr. Crofters. And but I think it's pretty kosher, but I think there's a whole lot of editing because they have people, they have valuations all day, so they're only going to pick the ones which they think are worthy of it. There's a man who values glass on it, who I love. I can't remember what he's called, but he looks completely nuts. And he's fun. I like the really oddball valuers. One who does porcelain too. Sounds like something out of the 1940s Mayfair.
Okay, yes. So we've got to wrap up soon.
Okay.
And we've got two categories to look at. One is books and one is music. And I'm going to give you a clue about something you let us know you really liked. And that is the deluxe town of Las Vegas for books and the first piano concerto for music. So what goes on in your head with these two?
Well, no, I mean, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Hunter S. Thompson, you know, is my favourite genre of... He is him, and this, funny enough, there's a photographer who we collect called Philip Lorca de Courcy, but both of those come from... They are the Americans that came to Britain, went to a pub, got a pub measure and thought it was a free sample. And you could take it from there, really. And... And I think the first half of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is the funniest thing I've ever met. But no, it's irresponsible and it's kind of fun. And sadly, Hunter S. Shot himself about 15 years ago now, I guess.
So let's just now move on and... I want to talk about music, if that's possible. And one more thing after that. So, Charlie, music, what are you going to go for?
Oh, okay. Well, with the music, you know, Elvis is absolutely it as far as I'm concerned. You know, the American trilogy being the one. But as of recent years, I've become big on classical and I do love... anything really. I love all the classic violin concertos. The first bit of classical music I ever really liked was Grieg's piano concerto in A flat minor, played, I think, by Arthur Rubinstein.
All right.
We used to listen to his garden in the 1970s, wheel the old mahogany grandpa out. That's it, really. I mean, when Elvis died, much to my father's absolute horror, in 1977, I got up at Sotheby's, big sale of the year, grabbed the microphone for the auctioneer and said, I'd like to do a tribute to the late, great Elvis Presley, the King, and launched into blue suede shoes and find myself on the front page of the Daily Mirror with Cheeky Charlie Goes for a Song.
Never slow in coming forward. And that is an extraordinary story. And I'm glad that nobody... had a shotgun with them. You know, really good to hear that, actually. I was somebody who liked Elvis, but I liked, you know, the first early albums, you know, and his voice is amazing, and he had an amazing band.
Yeah.
But let's not talk about The King anymore at all. The Grieg mention, I think we might put on our website, because I think that's a lovely piece. So this has all been really, really interesting stuff. I know many people who would enjoy listening to you, listening to this, you know, whether they're 14, 15, 18, 19, or whether they're 27, 28, or whether they're actually, you know, 58. It really doesn't matter. There's a lot of stuff that we have put down. Rather that you have put down. And, you know, I always wanted this show not to be teachy or didactic, but for people to learn stuff out of real experience. And I hope we've got there. So in closing, you know, if you are 17, 27, or 47, and life is looking like it's heading south, not very good, and you are really fed up, what advice, what help would you offer somebody now?
Well, I think firstly, you know, gratuitous advice from some old duffer like myself is usually pretty unwelcome. But if forced, I would say that, you know, there is always a chance it's going to get better. I mean, I really didn't come into my own until I was over 60, for God's sake, which is, you know, as Chelsea supporters might say, coming from behind, you know, as Chelsea went from three down to winning the match by a goal. So I guess the thing is, the big changer for me was taking responsibility and getting that message on board and not to blame everything on my background or this, that or the other. And the other big thing I find is the most helpful is I am big on self-mockery, you know. Other people, I mock myself, I often mock other people. I don't even notice the fact that they're not actually taking it very well at all. In fact, several have never spoken to us again. But that's their problem, not mine. So I guess, you know, hope and humour are two big elements.
Wonderful. Really good. I like hope, humour and walking.
Yep.
Okay, well, that's just brilliant. There's a lot of stuff here, as I've said before. And you've been a real sport and top geezer. And I want to thank you so much for coming and allowing us to irritate you with Zoom things that haven't worked and this that hasn't worked and that that has worked. And I hope we're going to hear back from you in a year's time for a refresher. Charlie, thank you so much.
Tim, my partner, there's nothing Charlie enjoys more than talking about himself, so... Yeah, you can ask on as often as you like. Thanks, Jeremy.
Brilliant. Thank you very, very much, Charlie.
Bye.
Cue the apple on the head music. And now it's a great privilege me to welcome my very old friend and top psychologist, Karen Cowan.
Hello.
Lovely to have you on the Zoom and the clean feed and all the other things we're working with. Really great. What was your instant impression?
I think I thought that Charlie was an amazing survivor. And he talks about privilege, but anyone less privileged, I couldn't think of in a way. And I think sometimes that privilege in terms of material goods masks very difficult problems that can happen to anyone who is so-called privileged or who's not. So I wonder if that's something about why Charlie's so keen not to be seen as a victim.
Yes, that really came across as a big thing. And I can only think that sometimes some people have a pathological hatred of being seen to have a weakness. But he's a very honest, I found him very honest, very funny, and very brave, actually, in what's happened in his life and what... talking about everything just now, I thought it was, you know, great, really good.
Yes, I think he came across, as I say, as an incredible survivor, and I think he's kind of got a message of hope for people as well, because he was a late developer, as it were, and good things happened to him late in life, good things which he really deserved.
Yes, I think that is a brilliant point. You know, that really it took him to his 50s, late 50s, you know, to find, success, love, all of those things. And I think you're so right to say that, because you must see so many people in your practice who go, oh, blimey, it's all over. You know, I'll never amount to anything now. And I think that is a real hope.
Yes, I think that's one of the things I've learned while working as a psychologist. It really is never too late to kind of get a bit more okay and get over whatever's happened to you, or rather accept what's ever happened to you and begin to build the life that you deserve.
Yes, I tended to think with Charlie that, rather like his fantastic forays into the supermarket, you know, to buy the latest bargain or, you know, orchid, whatever it is, he's actually somebody who's worked out the hard way of how to get well, stay well. And I wondered if I could just ask you about that, which he said that it was very important to him. Talking was very important because he couldn't take antidepressants or anything like that. And that he went on to talk about CBT. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yes. I mean, I think we all know, I hope we all know, that talking to somebody is very much the first step if you're feeling low, depressed, anxious. Not everybody has someone to talk to, but you can, there's the Samaritans and various lines, just the first step. But I think that, as you say, Charlie mentioned CBT, and that's so helpful, particularly if you can't take antidepressants or would prefer not to take antidepressants. It works primarily on the idea that how we think affects how we behave, affects our emotions, affects our physical state, and round, all linking to each other. And I suppose one example might be that if you walk down the street and you see your friend and he ignores you, the way you think about it is going to affect the way you behave and the way you feel emotionally, possibly the way you feel physically. You could think about it, oh, he's probably got things on his mind. He's not wearing his glasses. I need to help him, or whatever. Or you could think he's ignoring me because he knows I'm an idiot. So cognitive behavioral therapy very much focuses on looking at the ways you think and how they play into how you feel.
Right. And presumably the more you do of that, the more it makes sense, because it's you're learning good practice as opposed to bad.
Yes, very much so. And of course, if you really think about it, our whole lives are really based on what we think. And cognitive behavioral therapy is very much investigating how we think about things and how we behave and our emotions. So the links between them. So very much it's practice with cognitive behavioral therapy. And it sounds like Charlie really has practiced.
Yes, I think that's right, because, I mean, everything, you know, without it being a Hollywood fairy tale, has come right for him in terms of, you know, that he's got a successful art business. But of course, you know, he wrote Dear Lupin, Lucky Lupin. He's done another book on his father. He's got Tim, his partner. I mean, all the sort of boxes have been ticked, and that sounds crass, but I mean, I just ask you a couple of things more, Bruni, because I think it's interesting looking back at his childhood. To me, I understand this, you know, his dog died, 14-year-old dog died that he'd had since a puppy. His parents moved from a rather sweet, lovely, you know, idyllic little village where he did the paper round and he did this and did that, to a sort of mini town that he didn't like. And then he was sort of told he was going to Eton, and he didn't really want to go to Eton because he didn't feel he fitted in. So those things to me seemed quite some, you know, I don't know whether they're triggers, you know, I don't know what you think.
I think very, very much so. I think particularly early childhood is the major impact on how you're likely to feel in later life. If you tell a little boy of 4 that his painting is rubbish, he's not going to paint again. If you tell him it's lovely, he is going to paint again. So whatever happens to you in childhood is going to, there's no two ways about it, it's going to have a major effect on your life. I wonder also, and there's some research saying this, that there is a somewhat of a genetic element to alcoholism. For example, there's a gene that they've located that makes people not feel sick if they drink alcohol. So that's another reason why you don't kind of stop drinking on about. But my own feeling is that much of it is about your early childhood experience.
Yes, and looking at what Charlie said, which was that alcohol played a huge part in his family, you know, it was like a sort of de rigueur, you know, that everyone drank. And there were lots of people in the 1970s who were like that, no doubt about it. But you wonder, without being indelicate, his mum clearly had quite some problems.
Well, I would think that in his childhood, I mean, one of the hallmarks of alcoholism, as you know, is erratic parenting and unpredictability. And I think that would have been likely to have a major effect on Charlie as a child. Not knowing where you stand when you're a small child is very, very difficult. But I think that perhaps what, I may be speaking out of turn, but perhaps what kind of saved Charlie was the love of his father shown through the letter writing. And perhaps he managed to retain some self-esteem, Charlie, through that. And that's what's helped him fight through that and the CBT. And now I think the love of his partner.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, his father, you sort of really want to meet just because of those letters. I mean, they are, very funny, but beautifully written. I mean, it's been fascinating talking to Charlie and, you know, getting to know him. And I can see that he could annoy people. But to me, he was so open and non-bullshit. I think it was a real delight.
I think sometimes that real fighters, people who've had to fight a lot in their life, do come across as somewhat flip because they fought so hard and they are trying to remain positive all the time. And honesty is part of remaining positive. So they can come across as extremely jolly. But it's actually part of their survival and what's helped them survive.
Yes, yes. Well, that's a very big thing. And I think one of the interesting things that he talked about was he said that loyalty is everything to me. And, I think it was in some response to something I'd said about his mother, which was maybe back off, you old git, Jeremy. But I wonder if that's a similar thing, loyalty to the honesty.
No, I think loyalty and honesty are two very, very different things. And quite interestingly, I think loyalty is obviously a wonderful quality, but I know that in my practice,
yes,
one of the most difficult thing for patients or clients or whatever you like to call them about being in therapy was the fear of dobbing in their parents.
Oh.
And I think a good therapist kind of works to make you kind of feel that you're not actually dobbing them in, but that they did the things for their own reasons. But I think sometimes the loyalty actually holds people back because they feel, I can't say that about mum. I can't think that about mum. I can't think that about dad.
Yes.
And it's quite trapping.
Yes. I never heard that before. It's a first, Karen. It's an absolute first. That's brilliant.
Well, I see it a lot in practice. I see it a lot in practice. Even people who've been sexually abused want to remain loyal to their abuser.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It does happen, doesn't it? But even so, that's very, very interesting. Well, I think we've sort of come to the end of our little section, and the message is that we have arranged a knighthood for Charlie, which is great. But also to say that don't do that at home. I think Charlie Mortimer is someone who makes light of some stuff that is very, very, very tricky and awful to go through. And, you know, his gift to us is to tell us the truth, which he has. And, you know, our gift is to have Karen Cowan on our show every week.
Well, thank you very, very much. And I think that's interesting because, again, lots of my clients and patients do make light of the most enormous things because that's been their lived experience. Their life is those things. So you can tend to make light of them.
Yes. And of course, you know, that's a coping mechanism for a lot of people. But if you are 15 and listening to that, my message is don't do that at home. You
know, no, certainly not.
Watch somebody else do it.
Yes. If you feel bad, that is okay. You need to talk.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there is nothing sexy or romantic about heroin addiction.
No, most certainly not.
Yeah, well, we'll go into that when I hope we're going to have the privilege of having the Karen Cowan show and listening to you and talking to you for 30 or 40 minutes. That's great. Thank you so much, Karen. Absolutely brilliant. I don't think we're going to do another one before Christmas, which is obviously a great disappointment. But we will be back in January and have a very, very groovy time.
That's wonderful. Goodbye. Great. I look forward to the new year.
All right.
All right.
See you later.
See you later.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Shed Talks, episode 2. If you've experienced any really grotty interference or you felt that an oil tanker was coming into your listening space, we are sorry, but there are various gremlins we have to get through on the Our Shed Talks, so don't be put off, just stay with us. Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to B. Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. And lastly, thank you to Charlie Mortimer, our top guest. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram @JeremyThomasTalks. We've had quite a lot of inquiries about what the theme tune is, and it's called The Beast, and it's written and performed by Milt Buckner. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe this Christmas, be groovy, and look forward to hearing and seeing you again next year. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.